The Fry Chronicles, an autobiography written and read by Stephen Fry. Work is more fun than fun. Noel Coward. I really must stop saying sorry. It doesn't make things any better or worse. If only I had it in me to be all fierce, fearless and forthright instead of forever sprinkling my discourse with pitiful retractions, apologies and prevarications. It's one of the reasons I could never have been an artist, either of a literary or any other kind. All the true artists I know are uninterested in the opinion of the world and wholly unconcerned with self-explanation. Self-revelation, yes, and often, but never self-explanation. Artists are strong, bloody-minded, difficult, and dangerous. Fate, or laziness, or cowardice, cast me long ago in the role of entertainer, and that is what I found myself throughout my 20s becoming, though at times a fatally over-earnest, over-appeasing one, which is no kind of entertainer at all, of course. Wanting to be liked is often a very unlikable characteristic. Certainly I don't like it in myself. But then there is a lot in myself that I don't like. 12 years ago, I wrote a memoir of my childhood and adolescence called Moab is My Washpot, a title that confused no one, so clear, direct and obvious was its meaning and reference. Or perhaps not. The chronology took me up to the time I emerged from prison and managed somehow to get myself accepted into university, which is where this book takes up the story. For the sake of those who have read Moab, I don't mean to go over the same ground. This book picks up the threads and charts the next 8 years of my life. Why so many pages for so few years? It was a late adolescence and early manhood crowded with incident, that is one answer. Another is that in every particular I fail Strunk's Elements of Style or any other manual of good writing. If a thing can be said in 10 words, I may be relied upon to take 100 to say it. I ought to apologise for that. I ought to go back and ruthlessly prune, pare and extirpate excess growth. But I will not. I like words. Strike that. I love words. And while I am fond of the condensed and economical use of them in poetry, in song lyrics, in Twitter, in good journalism and smart advertising, I love the luxuriant profusion and mad scatter of them too. If my manner of writing is a self-indulgence that has you grinding your teeth, then I'm sorry, but I'm too old a dog to be taught to bark new tunes. I hope you forgive the unedifying sight of my struggle to express some of the truths of my inner self and to measure the distance between the mask of security, ease, confidence and assurance I wear, so easily that its features often lift into a smirk that looks like complacency and smugness, and the real condition of anxiety, self-doubt, self-disgust and fear in which much of my life then and now is lived. It is a life, I suppose, as interesting or as uninteresting as anyone else's. It is mine, and I can do what I like with it, both in the world, in the real plane of facts and objects, and on the page, in the even more real plane of words and subjects. It is not for me to be so cavalier with the lives of others, however. In much of my life, from 1977 to 1987, people appear who are known in the public world and to whom I cannot give convincing pseudonyms. If I told you, for example, that at university I met a man called Liu Horry and that we embarked on a comic career together, it might not take great insight or too much googling on your part to know that I was writing about a real person. It's not for me to go blabbing about his life and loves, personal habits, mannerisms and modes of behaviour, is it? On the other hand, were I simply to say that everyone I met in my journey through life was darling and gorgeous and super and lovely and talented and dazzling and sweet, you would soon enough be arcing streams of hot vomit all over the place and in every probability short-circuiting your e-book reader. I don't doubt for a minute that my publishers have already made it clear in the small print of the contract I signed with them that I, the author, am responsible for all lawsuits appertaining to, but not restricted to, emetic and bodily fluid damage to electronic reading devices in this and all territories. So I am sailing between the Scylla of protecting the wholly reasonable privacy of friends and colleagues and the Charybdis of causing you, the reader, to sick up. It is a narrow course, and I shall do my best to steer it safely. These pages deal with some of the C-words that have dominated my life. Before the chronology of the Chronicles commences, let me catalogue a couple more C's, to put you, as it were, in the mood. C is for C12H22011, for cereal, for candy, for caries, for cavities, for carbohydrates, for calories. Shades of the prison house begin to close upon the growing boy. William Wordsworth, Intimations of Mortality. To care about my body would be to suggest that I had a body worth caring about. Since my earliest years, I felt nothing but shame for the useless casing of flesh I inhabit. It couldn't bowl, bat, or catch. It couldn't dance. It couldn't ski, dive, or leap. When it walked into a bar or club, it didn't attract lustful glares of desire or even faint glances of interest. It had nothing to recommend it beyond its function as a fuel cell for my brain and a dumping ground for toxins that might reward me with rushing highs and reasons to be cheerful. Perhaps it all comes down to breasts, or the lack of them. While it is true that I was once a babe, I was never, I think, a suckling. I have no memories of being clamped to the nipple, and believe myself to have been bottle-fed from the beginning. There are psychologists, schooled in this tradition or that, whether Kleinian, Freudian, Adlerian, Jungian, or insert name Herian, I cannot say, who hold that the tit or teat issue has a significant, even crucial, bearing on human development. I can't recall whether the theory suggests it is the denial of mother's milk or the overabundant supply of it that stores up problems for later life, possibly both. A lot of bosom pressed into your face at a tender age, and you could grow up with a Russ Meyer or Jonathan Ross breast fixation. Nothing but bottle to suck, and you'd develop a horror of bosoms, or a propensity towards drink in general, or perhaps the other way around. All absolute poppywash, of course. False mammary syndrome. There are plenty of brothers and sisters, identical twins even, fed on the same infant diets, who have turned out different in every particular, except the irrelevant one of physical appearance. My brother and sister were treated just as I was in infancy, and we could not be, fortunately for them and the world, less alike. So let us suppose that the vices and weaknesses that I am going to tell you about now are peculiar to me and were bestowed upon me at birth along with the moles on the back of my legs and the whorls on the pads of my fingers. Which is not to say that I am uniquely alone in the possession of these weaknesses. Far from it. They might almost be called the failings of my generation. Once we get beyond milk, whether breast or formula, we move on to the hard stuff, solid food. Happy spoonfuls of applesauce and beef casserole are pushed into us until we can wield cutlery for ourselves. One of the first and most forcible ways in which a child's character begins to express itself is through its attitude to food. In the late 1950s and early 1960s, food meant breakfast cereal and sweets. I was one of the first wave of infants to be exposed to child-targeted advertising. Sugar Puffs were born, as was I, in 1957. That cereal, which no one could pretend had any ambition to be eaten by adults, was represented a decade before the arrival of the Honey Monster by a real live bear called Jeremy. He led a busy life being photographed for the carton and filmed for television commercials until he was finally retired into private life, ending up, after a short period at Cromer Zoo, in Campertown, Dundee, where he died peacefully in his sleep in 1990. I visited him at Cromer, the first celebrity I ever saw in the flesh, or in the fur, and believe me, what the A-listingest Hollywood babe or pop idol is to a child now, Jeremy the Bear was to me then. You have to understand the passion, the love, the greed and the need. Sugar puffs were pellets of wheat that had been puffed up under heat and coated in a syrupy and slightly sticky fructose and glucose glaze. All you had to do to enjoy their glory was to pour on cold milk. Hot milk was possible for winter days, but it created a soggy bowlful closer to soup than cereal. Besides, hot milk that approached boiling point could form a surface skin, and a skin on milk caused me to vomit. To this day, the sight or smell of boiled milk makes me keck and puke. I'm put in mind of the cocktails they tell of Cocteau's cocktail parties. They say that Jean Cocteau, to amuse his friends, could lie back naked on a table and bring himself to full ejaculatory orgasm without touching himself, through the power of imaginative thought alone. I have a similar gift. I can make myself vomit by picturing skin on hot milk, custard or coffee. We can both make hot fluids spit and spurt from our bodies. I can't but feel that Cocteau's party piece is always likely to be more in demand than mine. The breakfast table was where the seeds of my sorrow were sown. I'm sure that I'm right in locating my first addiction here. Sugar puffs were the starting link in a chain that would shackle me for most of my life. To begin with, as you might imagine, they were a breakfast habit. But soon I was snacking on them at any time of day until my mother began to sigh at the number of packets she was forced to buy. I would eat the sweet pellets loose from the box. One after the other, without stopping, into the mouth they would go. I was like an American at the cinema with popcorn, eyes glazed, hand rising and falling, packed to mouth, packed to mouth, packed to mouth, like a machine. Eyes glazed. Is that important? A child at the breast or bottle has that look. There is a sexual element to such unfocused fixity. Until I was about 8 or 9, I sucked the first 2 fingers of my left hand almost all the time, while twiddling the hair on the crown of my head with the fingers of my right hand, and always with that glazed, faraway look, with parted lips and laboured breath. Was I giving myself the breast treat that I'd been denied? These are dark waters, Watson. Cereal packet lists of ingredients and serving suggestions were my literature. Thiamine, riboflavin and niacin, my mysterious invisible friends. Sold by weight, not volume. Contents may have settled during transport. Insert finger under flap and move from side to side. They're great. We like ricicles, they're twicicles as nicicles. And so they were. In fact, as I like to say, they were thricicles as nicicles. Certainly much nicicler than their staid, unsweetened parent Rice Krispies, the cereal that said, if you listened carefully, snot, pickle and crap. To have Rice Krispies, when you could have ricicles. To have cornflakes, when you could have Frosties. Who could imagine such a dull life? It was like deliberately choosing to watch the news on television or preferring to drink unsweetened tea. I lived for one thing and one thing only, C12H22011. Perhaps this is why I should have been American, for they have sugar everywhere in the United States, in bread, in bottled water, in beef jerky, pickles, mayonnaise, mustard and salsa. Sugar, sugar, sugar. My relationship with this beguiling and benighted substance is complicated. I should never have been born if it weren't for sugar, and yet it came close to killing me, too. I told elsewhere the story of the role of my mother's father in bringing sugar to Britain. I latterly found out more as a result of taking part in the BBC's genealogy programme Who Do You Think You Are? My grandfather, Martin Neumann, came to Bury St. Edmunds, not to praise him, all the way from the land of his birth, which was originally Hungary, though the 1920 Treaty of Trianon later absorbed his hometown of Nagy-Sharany into the newly expanded Czechoslovakia. For the purposes of history, however, he was from Hungary. A Hungarian Jew, as he liked to observe, is the only man who can follow you into a revolving door and come out first. He came to Britain at the invitation of the Ministry of Agriculture in Whitehall, whose more far-sighted functionaries realised that if there was, as seemed increasingly likely, to be another world war, the Atlantic would almost certainly be cut off, as it so nearly had been at the height of the German U-boat threat of 1917. The West Indies and Australia would be out of reach, and there would be no sugar for the British cup of tea, a disaster too horrible to contemplate. Britain was entirely without native sugar capacity, its farmers never having grown a single beet, its industrialists never having refined a single ounce. Back in Nodshirani, now Shirani, my grandfather had been the manager of what was then the largest sugar refinery in the world, so he seemed like a natural candidate for British recruitment. In 1925, he and his brother-in-law, Robert Yorish, came to build Britain its first sugar beet refinery in Bury St Edmunds, Suffolk, where it stands to this day, emitting a rich and bitter pong, faintly reminiscent of burnt peanut butter. Had Martin and his wife and family remained in Shirani, they would, being Jews, have been exterminated in the Nazi death camps, as were his mother, sister, parents-in-law, and the dozens of other family members who stayed in Europe. I should never have been born, and the paper or digital display technology that has gone into the production of the book you are now listening to with such unalloyed pleasure would have been put to other uses. So sugar gave me life, but it exacted a price, slavish adherence. Addiction to it, and an addiction to addiction in addition. Sweetened breakfast cereals were one thing, and relatively harmless at that. Weekly boxes of sugar puffs, ricicles and frosties would be ordered by my mother over the telephone and delivered, along with the rest of the groceries, by Mr. Neal, who always called me young man, and who drove the van for Riches, the little store in the village of Reefham, which lay some 2 or 3 miles away from our home hamlet of Booton. Men like Mr. Neal no longer exist. Little stores like Riches no longer exist. As a result of Mr. Neal's weekly deliveries, I could eat almost as much breakfast cereal as I wanted without having to spend any money. My sugar hit was free. Of course it was. Why wouldn't it be? I was a child who lived in a house where there were always sugar puffs in the cupboard. Perfectly normal and natural. All this changed when, at the age of 7, I was sent to a Gloucestershire preparatory school almost exactly 200 miles from our Norfolk home. My introductory morning at Stout's Hill, for such was the school's name, presented the first in what was to be a long line of disappointments. After a night of homesick weeping and lonely hiccupping, I had awoken to the bumptious din and frightening mystery of an alien institution going about its daily rites. "You, what are you doing? You should be in the refectory," a prefect shouted at me as I caromed panic-stricken down random corridors.
"Please, what's a refectory?"
A picture of some kind of medieval punishment chamber arose in my terrified mind. The prefect grabbed me by the shoulders and steered me down a passageway and down another and finally through a door that led into a long, low dining room crowded with loudly breakfasting boys sitting on long, shiny oak forms, as benches used to be called. He marched me to one, prized 2 boys apart, hoisted me up and wedged me into the space between. I sat there, blinking with frightened embarrassment. Timidly raising my head, I saw that there was cereal available. Cornflakes or lumpy cooked porridge. Of sugar puffs, frosties and ricicles there was no sign. I might make the claim that life was never the same again, that trust, faith, hope, belief and confidence died in me that day, and that thenceforward melancholy marked me for her own. But perhaps that would be pitching it a touch strong. Nonetheless, I was shocked. Was there now to be no sweetness in my life? The school did have one institution that counterbalanced the troubling deficiencies of the refectory. Tuck, as you may know, is an old-fashioned English school slang word for sweets, what Americans call candy. While I had encountered sweets before, of course I had, they had usually come in quarter-pound bags scooped from large glass jars in Riches or Reefham post office, pear drops, sherbet lemons, toffee eclairs, humbugs and fruit bonbons, all rather dowdy, respectable and pre-war. The Stout's Hill School tuck shop offered wilder excitements in this, the rising golden age of confectionery. Cadbury's, Fry's, hurrah, Roundtree's, Nestle's, Macintosh's, Mars and Terry's were still individual independent manufacturers. From Macintoshes came Rolos, Caramac and Toffee Crisp. From Fries, hurrah, Turkish Delight, Crunchy Bars and Chocolate Cream. Cadbury's gave us the Picnic and the Flake, as well as their signature dairy milk wrapped in delicate purple foil. The Bourneville Giants were even then preparing to launch within 1 year of each other the legendary Curly Whirly and the greatest chocolate bar in the history of the world, the Aztec. Nestle's, meanwhile, offered us the Milky Bar. Roundtree's had the Kit Kat and the Aero, fruit pastels, fruit gums, Smarties and Jelly Tots. Mars had the Milky Way, Mars Bar, Maltesers and Marathon. Bless my soul, I never noticed till now that the Mars products all began with M. Marathon would many years later be rechristened Snickers, of course, and I would help launch the new name by recording the voiceover for its advertising campaign. If I had known such a thing might happen back then, I might well have exploded. Just as Mars opal fruits would one day become Starburst. Doubtless they had their reasons. They also produced Spangles, the square boiled sweet that has become shorthand for just the kind of lazy, overwrought nostalgia in which I am now wallowing. But hang in there if you will. There is a point to all this beyond the mere fevered recitation of brand names. The Stouts Hill Tuck Shop was open for business on different days for each of the four houses into which the school was divided, Kingfishers, Otters, Wasps and Panthers. I was an Otter, and our Tuck Day was Thursday. First, you queued up for cash. Whatever pocket money your parents had allocated you was kept in trust and doled out in instalments by the master on duty, who recorded the withdrawn sum on your individual page in the pocket money ledger. As the term wore on, I watched in dismay as my capital dwindled away. Desperate letters were written home, begging for a 10-shilling note to be sent as soon as possible. "Please, Mummy, please. All the other boys have got enough money to last them forever. Oh, please, please, please." And so it began. Glorious as the Stouts Hill Tuck Shop may have been, it was but a John the Baptist to the messianic radiance of the Yulee Village Shop, unworthy to tie its red licorice bootlaces or lick its sherbet dabs. The little post office and general stores was just half a mile from the school gates, and we would pass in crocodile formation on supervised walks through the village, turning our heads in unison towards its inviting windows, like cadets honouring their monarch with an eyes right. On the shelves of that shop gleamed, glistened and twinkled the most exotic, colourful and sugary sweet treasure I had ever seen or ever dreamed of. Jamboree bags, tree-bore refreshers, fruit salads and blackjacks a farthing each, that's four for one old penny. Foam shrimps, rice paper flying saucers filled with sherbet, swizzles, matlow twizzlers that fizzed and popped in the mouth like fireworks, love hearts, chewy sour cola bottles and rubbery white milk bottles, chocolate buttons sprinkled with hundreds and thousands, strips of Wrigley's juicy fruit and spearmint, boxes of Chiclets and Pez, loose cubes of Bazooka Joe, and packs of Beatles branded bubblegum, each one with a card inside that offered a picture and priceless biographical information. John hates marmalade, but Ringo is very fond of lemon curd. George is the tallest beetle, but only by half an inch. And other devastating and valuable secrets, all finished with the exclamation marks that remain a characteristic of fan literature to this day. On other shelves there were gobstoppers, aniseed balls and everlasting strips, sherbet fountains, dabs and dips, wine gums, wagon wheels and walnut whips. Forgive the accidental rhyming. There was the much-prized Spanish gold, pouches of yellow waxed paper with a picture of a red galleon on the front, packed with strands of shredded coconut, browned with chocolate powder to make it look like rolling tobacco. Licorice curved into a Sherlock Holmes pipe, complete with bowl and stem. White candy cigarettes with red ends and rice paper-wrapped chocolate cigarettes presented in a fake Chesterfield's carton. All the elements were now in place. Sugar, white powder, tobacco, desire, lack of money, the forbidden. Yes, forbidden. The village shop was out of bounds to all boys. The extra sugariness of the sweets, the blindingly bright cheerfulness of the wrappers, and the loutish American informality of chewing gum and gobstoppers offended the mostly military sensibilities of the staff.
The produce was all somehow just a bit vulgar. Just a bit, well, frankly, just a bit working class.
Heaven knows what those same poor schoolmasters would have made of Haribo Star Mix or the Kinder Happy Hippo. It is perhaps as well that they predeceased such unpleasantnesses, for I'm sure their hearts would have given out. 7 years old, 200 miles from home, and a deprived addict. There are plenty of stories of children younger than 7 who are already full alcoholics or were born addicted to crack cocaine, crystal meth and Red Bull, and I am fully aware that my sugar dependency reads as tame by comparison. The fact of it is an indictment of nothing and a lesson to nobody, nor is it satisfactorily explicable. I have given you the outline of it, but that does not suggest necessary or sufficient cause for so compulsive and all-consuming an addiction. After all, my contemporaries were subjected to the same advertising, had available the same cereals, candies and comestibles, and were compounded of the same organs, senses and dimensions. Yet from my very earliest consciousness, I sensed with savage, unswervable certainty that other people were not seized by the same rapacious greed, insatiable hunger, overmastering desire, shivering lust, and terrible hurting need that had me in its grip almost every hour of every day. Or if they were, they had levels of self-control that entirely shamed me. Perhaps, I wondered, perhaps everyone but me was strong, characterful, and morally assured. Perhaps only I was so weak as to succumb to appetites that others could control. Perhaps everyone else was equally gnawed by equally keen desires, but had been granted by nature or the Almighty an ability to master their emotions that in my trembling desolation I had been denied. We should consider that the atmosphere of my school, like that of any given private school in those days and many today, quivered with righteous religiosity. Today's schools quiver with righteousness without the religiosity, which is only just an improvement. You might be able to imagine, then, something of the spiritual torture that accompanied some of my more corporeal agonies. The Bible is crammed from end to end with stories of temptation, interdiction, and chastisement. A forbidden fruit hangs from a tree on the very first page, and as we go through we are given more terrible lessons on how greed is punished and lust accursed until we reach the full, final, and insane damnations and ecstasies of St. John's Revelations, having passed through wildernesses and desert trials, locusts, honey, manna, ravens, sores, boils, plagues, scourges, tribulations, and sacrifices. Lead us not into temptation, get thee behind me, Satan, vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, I will repay. In such an atmosphere, with such a physiological craving already in place, it is little wonder that guilty connections came to be made in my mind between sugar and desire and satisfaction and desire and satisfaction and shame. All this years before the even fiercer terrors and torments of sex were to make themselves known to me and carve in my heart and bowels the same pattern, gouging it, of course, with deeper and crueler cuts. I say, I am a self-dramatizer, aren't I? Since 90% of my schoolfellows appeared immune to all this trauma, introspection, shame and temptation, I still wonder, looking back, whether I was especially weak, especially sensitive or especially sensual. To pay for sweets, I stole from shops, from the school, and, most shamefully of all, from other boys. These acts of theft were conducted, like the eating, in an almost trance-like state. Shallow of breath, eyes glazed over, I would ransack the changing rooms and desks, my insides churning with fear, elation, dread, and passionate self-disgust. At night, I would raid the school kitchens, homing in on a cupboard in which were stored great catering-sized blocks of raw jelly that I tore with my teeth like a lion tearing an antelope. I chronicled in Moab the occasion when I was found by a prefect to be in possession of contraband sweets, bubblegum and sherbet fountains that could only have come from the village shop. I persuaded a good-natured little fellow called Bunce, who quietly hero-worshipped me, to take the rap. I had been guilty of so many prior transgressions that one more would result in a severe caning, whereas Bunce, who had no form and no record, would be let off with a warning.
It all backfired, of course, and the headmaster saw through our little stratagem. My reward was an extra special beating for having been so wicked as to lure an innocent like Bunce into my web of sin. The real-life Bunce and I have been in touch since the publication of Moab. He was very good-natured about it, and reminded me of an event I had entirely forgotten. Very early on in my school life, I had told Bunce that my parents were dead. "How terrible for you!" Bunce, always kindly, was deeply moved. "Yes, car crash. I have three aunts that I get handed around during the school holidays. You must swear not to tell anyone, though. It's a secret." Bunce nodded, a look of stout defiance on his downy face. I knew that he would sooner cut out his own tongue than say a word to anyone. Towards the end of term, I asked Bunce what plans he had for Christmas. He looked uncomfortable as he confessed that he was off with his family to the West Indies. "What about you?" he asked. "Duh, in Norfolk with my parents, of course. Where else?" But I thought your parents were dead and that you lived with aunts." "Ah. Yes. Damn. Busted." Bunce looked hurt and confused. "You mustn't mind me," I said, staring at him fixedly. "You see, I..." "Yes?" "I say these things." We never spoke of it again, not until Bunce reminded me of it 45 years later. He remembered the incident with absolute clarity. "I say these things" were, he maintains, my exact words. Regularly caned, always in trouble, never stable, never settled in or secure, I left prep school a sugar addict, thief, fantasist, and liar. The pattern continued at my next school, Uppingham in Rutland. More stealing, more sweets. By this time, the sheer quantity of sugary food I had gorged upon was beginning to take a real and painful physical toll. Not in the waistline, for I was as skinny as a pencil, but in the mouth. Caries, cavities, and cankerous ulcers were constant companions. By my 14th birthday, I had lost 5 of my back teeth forever. The need for sugar was destroying me. The rush of excitement as I stole, and the rush from the sugar as I sat and feasted on the kill, inevitably ended, such is the way of passion, in the crash of guilt, melancholia, nausea, and self-disgust that follow all such addictions. Sugar, shopping, alcohol, sex, you name it. More stealing resulted in a rustication, which was the public school word for being sent home for a few weeks. Suspension, I suppose one would call it now. Finally, the school could put up with me no longer, and I was expelled. I had gone to London on an officially sanctioned weekend away to attend a meeting of the Sherlock Holmes Society of London, of which I was an enthusiastic member. Instead of being in London for just 2 nights, as agreed, I stayed away for a week, blissfully locking myself into cinemas, watching film after film after film. Enough, as parents and schoolmasters never tired of saying, was enough. Tobacco's bitter juices will soon take over the story. Once that lovable leaf had me folded in its fond embrace, sugar never had quite the same hold over me again. But there is a little more yet to tell of my troubled relationship with C-12, age 22, 011. As I grew to late adolescence and early manhood, my loyalty to sugar puffs was little by little replaced with a passion for Scots porridge oats, made with cold milk, but generously sprinkled, to be sure, with spoonfuls of granulated sugar. At the same time, my childhood adoration of sherbet and fizzy chews gave way to a more adult preference for that altogether more sophisticated confection, chocolate. And, of course, there was coffee. It is 1982, and I am in a shabby set of rooms in London that belong to Granada Television. Ben Elton, Paul Shearer, Emma Thompson, Hugh Laurie and I are gathered there to rehearse for the first series of what will later become a TV sketch show called Al Fresco. The title of this first series is There's Nothing to Worry About. I wanted it to be called Trouser, 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 but was, perhaps rightly, overruled. We are in our early 20s and have left university 8 months earlier. Everything should be wonderful in our lives, and I suppose it is. Hugh, Emma, Paul and I have won the first Perrier Award at the Edinburgh Festival for our university review. A tour of Australia has followed. We have just come from filming that review for the BBC, and now we are about to create our very own television series. big sticky tins of Nescafe and boxes of PG Tips tea bags stand on a trestle table at one end of the room. There is something about rehearsal that encourages the consumption of great quantities of tea and coffee. This morning, as a sketch is being run through that everyone is in except me, it involves music and dancing, I make coffee for them all and realize, as my hand goes towards the teaspoon, that I am the only one who takes sugar. There I am, teaspoon poised over an open bag of Tate and Lyle. Suppose I were to give it up? I have always been told that tea and coffee are infinitely better without it. I look across at the others and vow there and then that I will go sugar-free for 2 weeks. If, after a fortnight of unsweetened coffee, I have failed to acquire a taste for it, I shall return to my 2.5 teaspoonfuls, none the worse off. I light a cigarette and watch the others. A rather splendid swell of proud elation surges up inside me. Perhaps I can do it. And I do. 10 days later, somebody hands me a coffee to which sugar has been added. I leap and start at the first sip as if I have been given an electric shock. It is the most wonderful shock of my life, for it tells me that I have succeeded in giving something up. It is far from the greatest tale of triumph over adversity you ever read, but that memory of myself staring at the bag of sugar and wondering if I really could quit never left me. It was to be the one faint whisper of hope in the bottom of Pandora's box. I can still smell that rehearsal room and hear its piano. I can still see the packets of biscuits on the trestle table and the Tate and Lyle bag, some of the sugar gathered into translucent crystalline lumps from the repeated insertion of a wet teaspoon. I saw and smelt and relived that scene once more 27 years later in a room at the Hotel Colbert in Antananarivo, Madagascar. It was very, very hot and very, very humid, and I was wearing nothing but boxer shorts. An approaching thunderstorm growled menacingly, and the hotel's internet connection, flaky at the best of times, failed. As I stood up from the desk to go to the bathroom, a terrible sight caught my eye. An enormously fat man with gigantic drooping bosoms and a vast overhanging belly was crossing the room. I checked, turned back, and stared in horror and disbelief. There he was again, filling the wardrobe mirror, a comically overweight middle-aged man, as grotesquely obese as anyone I had seen since I'd filmed in the American Midwest the year before. I inspected the bulk of this disgusting mountain of blubber from tip to toe and began to weep. I had spent the last quarter century seeing myself on large and small screens and photographed in newspapers and had never been under any illusions concerning my physical appearance, but for some reason on that evening in that room I saw myself as I was. I did not shudder, cover myself up, and move on. I did not pretend that everything was fine. I did not say to myself that I was tall enough to carry a little extra weight. I cried at the terrible thing I had become. There were scales in the bathroom. 139 kilograms. What was that in old-fashioned English? I had an app for that on my phone. 21 stone and 12 pounds. Holy imperial hell! 22 stone. 306 pounds. I remembered that rehearsal room in 1982. I'd managed to give up sugar in tea and coffee. Now it was time to give it up in all its manifestations. Puddings, chocolates, toffee, fudge, mints, ice cream, doughnuts, cakes, buns, tarts, flans, flapjacks, jelly and jam. I would have to exercise, too. It could not be a diet, it could only be a complete change in the way I ate and lived. I won't claim that not a single grain of sugar has passed my lips since that moment of epiphanic horror in Madagascar, but I have managed to avoid such tempting patisserie, puddings, candied fruits, chocolates, ices, petits fours and friandises as waiters present to one at the sort of restaurants in which me and my spoilt kind hang out. Combined with a regime of daily walks, thrice-weekly gym visits, and the general avoidance of starchy and fatty foods, this steadfast forbearance has allowed my weight to drop to something below 16 stone. I have not the slightest doubt that I could easily balloon again and find myself hurtling back up past the 21st, 22nd, 23rd, 24th and 25th floors like a cartoon character in an express lift. Constant vigilance is the watchword. It is no part of my business with you to maintain that I now fully know myself, but I think I can profess convincingly that I do at least know myself well enough to be nothing but doubtful and distrustful when it comes to any claims of solutions, cures, and arrivals at final destinations. Take smoking, for example. C is for cigarettes, for convict, for cundle, for corporal punishment. For common pursuit, for cessation. All they that love not tobacco and boys are fools. Christopher Marlowe. Given that I was so disruptive, disobliging, and disobedient as a schoolboy, it is perhaps surprising that I didn't smoke my first cigarette until I was 15. As if to compensate for being an early bloomer in matters of the mind, I had always been a late developer in matters of the body. My first orgasm and my first cigarette came later to me than they did to most of my contemporaries, and looking back, it is as though I spent decades trying to make up for lost time. I think I have always linked smoking and sex. Maybe this is where I've been going wrong all my life. In 1979, towards the end of my first year at Cambridge, I wrote a play called Latin, or Tobacco and Boys. Dominic Clarke, the hero, if such a title can be used of so warped a character, delivers a speech in the second act in which he describes and conflates his first sexual and smoking experience. One of those painful steps towards manhood was my first smoke. It was behind the fives courts of my house at school with a boy called Prestwick Agata. I can remember it as if it were 5 minutes ago. Prestwick Agata opened his packet of Carlton Premium and drew out a short, thin cigarette. As my lips rounded about the tip, I began to feel panic. I could hear my boyhood being strangled inside me and a new fire awakening. Prestwick Agata lit the end and I sucked and inhaled. The ears buzzed, the blood caught fire, and somewhere in the distance my boyhood moaned. I ignored it and sucked again, but this time my body rejected it and I coughed and expectorated. My boy's lungs couldn't take the filthy whirl of smuts I was so keen to introduce to them, and so I coughed and kept on coughing. Despite my inner excitement and my great coughing fit, I managed to maintain a cool, unruffled exterior with which to impress Prestwick Agata, who was amused by my coolness and pluck. British phlegm and British spunk flowed freely in me and out of me, and the public school spirit was born. After about an hour it began to rain, so we dashed into the nearest fives court and leant against the buttress. It was an afternoon of rare agony. It was later that evening, when a horde of uncouth Philistines was raiding my study, Prestwick Agata amongst them, that my voice broke. Really, quite suddenly. I was nearly 17. Rather embarrassing, really. While that speech was not, I assure you, autobiographical on my part, Dominic's response to sex and cigarettes does correspond largely to my own. I coughed and vomited rather badly. Not after sex, I should say, but after my first smoke, and after my second and third. Nature was giving me powerful hints that I chose to ignore. I was at home, 15 years old, disgraced and expelled when I started to smoke. My parents had chosen for me the Paston School in North Walsham, Norfolk, a direct grant grammar whose major claim to fame was having had Horatio Nelson as an unhappy pupil. To get there every morning required a ride on a motor coach that passed on its way to the school through the market town of Aylsham. After a few weeks of the Paston, I found myself getting off the bus at Aylsham and spending the day in a small cafe where I could smoke, drink frothy coffee, and play pinball until the coach came back through on its return journey. This chronic truancy resulted, of course, in another expulsion. Next, I was sent to NORCAT, the Norfolk College of Arts and Technology, in King's Lynn. Whatever money I could beg, borrow, or steal from my mother's handbag went on cigarettes. As an addiction, it was more expensive than sugar puffs or sweets, and almost as disastrous to teeth, yet wholly more acceptable socially. The average tuckshop ciggy brands for poor students were Players Number 6, Embassy, Carlton and Sovereign. If I had enjoyed a win at three-card brag, I might lash out on Rothmans, Dunhill or Benson and Hedges. But when I was truly in the funds, the tobacco equivalent of the Yulee Village shop beckoned. My obsession with Oscar Wilde, Baron Corvo and the appealingly poisonous world of late 19th-century decadence resulted in a pretentious preference for exotic brands. Sobrani Cocktails, Passing Cloud, Sweet Afton, Carroll's Major, Freiburg and Trier and Sullivan Powell Private Stock were the most desirable, especially the last two, which could only be bought from one specialist tobacconist shop in all of Norfolk or from their very own premises in London's Haymarket and Burlington Arcade. It was to London that I went when at last I ran away from King's Lynn. The threatening approach of exams and the probability that I would fail them had combined with a tiresome adolescent, I don't need no education attitude, all of which resulted in a cutting and running. Like Dr. Watson in the first Sherlock Holmes story, I found myself drawn to Piccadilly, that great cesspool into which all the loungers and idlers of the empire are irresistibly drained. Now I had someone else's credit cards to keep me in the very choicest brands of cigarette. Perched on a barstool in the American bar of the Ritz Hotel, I would sip cocktails, puff Sobranis, and think myself urbane. Somewhere along the way, I had snaffled and kept my grandfather's old collars and the leather box shaped like a horseshoe in which they were kept. Not only was I a 17-year-old trying to look like a compound of Wilde, Coward, Fitzgerald and Furbank, I was a 17-year-old in a Gatsby-style suit and starched wing collar smoking coloured cigarettes through an amber cigarette holder. It is extraordinary that I escaped a violent beating. What I did not escape was arrest. The police caught up with me in Swindon, and after a night in the cells I found myself banged up in a young offenders institution with the endearingly quaint Cotswold name of Pucklechurch. Tobacco, as is well known, is the major currency on the inside. Relative peace, control and stability are achieved within prison walls through structured jobs, but no convict could ever be relied upon to work were it not that the wages of his labour are the only means by which he can buy his snout, his burn, his baccy. He who has the most tobacco has the most status, influence, respect and contentment. That was certainly true in my day. It may all have changed since then. You might think that the really smart jailbird would therefore be a non-smoker, or at least have the sense to become one. There are almost none that smart, of course. There are plenty of clever jailbirds, but very few clever in quite that way. You can almost define a convict as one who lacks precisely the kind of wisdom and self-control necessary to derive long-term advantage from short-term discomfort. This deficiency is what will have turned them to crime in the first place, and what will have caused them to be inept enough at it to get caught and captured in the second. To expect a convict to have the strength to give up smoking is to expect a leopard to change his spots, become vegetarian, and learn to knit all on the same day. I was a natural criminal because I lacked just that ability to resist temptation or to defer pleasure for one single second. Whatever guard there is on duty in the minds and moral make-ups of the majority had always been absent from his post in my mental barracks. I'm thinking of the sentry who mans the barrier between excess and plenty, between right and wrong. "That's enough sugar puffs for now, we don't need another bowl," he would say in my friends' heads, or "one chocolate bar would be ample," or "gosh, look, there's some money, tempting, but it isn't ours." I never had such a guard on duty. Actually, that isn't quite true. Where Pinocchio had Jiminy Cricket, I had my Hungarian grandfather. He had died when I was 10, and ever since the day of his going, I had been uncomfortably aware that he was looking down and grieving over what the Book of Common Prayer would call my manifold sins and wickedness. I had erred and strayed from my ways like a lost sheep, and there was no health in me. Granddaddy watched me steal, lie and cheat. He caught me looking at illicit pictures in magazines, and he saw me play with myself. He witnessed all my greed and lust and shame. But for all his heedful presence, he could not prevent me from going to hell in my own way. If I had been psychopathic enough to feel no remorse, or religious enough to believe in redemption through a divine outside agency, perhaps I should have been happier. As it was, I had neither the consolation that I was free of guilt, nor the conviction that I could ever be forgiven. In jail, everyone inside rolled their own cigarettes. A week's wages could buy nearly enough Old Holborn or Golden Virginia tobacco to last the 7 days until next payday. The cigarette papers, for no good reason that I could understand, were the usual Rizla brand, but presented in a buff-coloured pack with the words HM Prisons Only printed at an angle across the flap. I hoarded as many of these as I could and contrived to smuggle them out on my release. For years afterwards I would refill these from the standard red, blue and green Rizla packs commercially available on the outside and enjoy the bragging rights of being seen with prison-issue rolling papers. Pathetic. I want so much to go back and slap myself sometimes. Not that I would pay the slightest attention. As the prison week ended and the less careful inmates began to run out of Bern, they went through a peculiar begging ritual that I, never one to husband resources either, was quick to learn. You would spot someone smoking and slide ingratiatingly up to them. "Two's up, mate," you would wheedle, and if you were the first to have got the request in, you would be rewarded with their fag end once they had done with it. These soggy second-hand butts, whose few remaining strands of precious tobacco were all bitter and tarred by the smoke that had passed through them, were as a date palm in the desert, and I would smoke them right down until they burnt and blistered my lips. We all know the indignities to which enslaved humans will submit themselves in order to satisfy their addictions, whether for narcotics, alcohol, tobacco, sugar, or sex. The desperation, savagery, and degradation they publicly display make truffling pigs seem placid and composed by comparison. That image of myself scorching my mouth and fingertips as I hungrily hissed in a last hit of smoke should have been enough to tell me all I needed to know about myself. It wasn't, of course. I had decided at school, when it had been borne in on me how hopeless I was at sport, that I was a useful brain on top of a useless body. I was mind and spirit, while those around me were mud and blood. The truth that I was more a victim of physical need than they were, I would angrily have repudiated, which just goes to show how complete an ass I was. After a month or so of remand in Pucklechurch, I was at last sentenced by the court to 2 years' probation and released back to my parents. This time around, I managed to enrol myself at a college and to sit for A-levels and the Cambridge entrance paper. Prison appeared to have marked the lowest point of my life. The suicide attempts, tantrums and madness of my mid-teens seemed to be over. Back home in Norfolk, I concentrated on academic work, achieved A grades and won a scholarship to read English at Queen's College, Cambridge. Now that I had the good news of my acceptance, I faced the problem of what to do with the months leading up to the first term. Unlike today's intrepid, elephant-hair-braceleted student adventurers and gap-year eco-warriors who hike the Inca Trail, work with lepers in Bangladesh, and dive and ski and surf and hang glide and Facebook their way around the world, having sex and wearing baggy shorts, I chose the already hideously old-fashioned challenge of teaching in a private school. I always believed that I was born to teach, and the world of the English prep school was one whose codes and manners I thoroughly understood. All the more reason for a stylish person to avoid such a place and seek new worlds and fresh challenges, one might suppose, but the systole and diastole of my disowning and belonging, rejecting and needing, escaping and returning were well established. I resist and scorn the England that bore me with the same degree of intensity with which I embrace and revere it. Perhaps, too, I felt that I owed it to myself to put right the failures of my own schooling by helping with the schooling of others. There was also the example of two of my literary heroes, Evelyn Waugh and W. H. Auden, who had each trodden this path. Waugh had even got material for his first novel out of the experience. Perhaps I would, too. I had added my name to the role of would-be schoolmasters, a role that resided somewhere in a copperplate hand among the roll-top desks, deckled ledgers, and Eastlight box files in the cosy, womb-like offices of the scholastic agency Gabitas Thring in Sackville Street, Piccadilly. Just 2 days after registering, a thin, piping voice called me up in Norfolk.
"We have a vacancy at a very nice prepper in North Yorkshire, Cundall Manor. Latin, Greek, French, and a little light rugger and soccer refereeing, as well as the usual duties, of course. Does that appeal?"
"Gosh, that's great. Do I have to go up for an interview?"
"Well, now, the happy fact is that Mr. Valentine, the father of Cundall's headmaster Jeremy Valentine, lives not far from you in Norfolk. He will see you."
Mr. Valentine was kind and cardiganed and very interested in my views on cricket. He poured me a generous schooner of Amontillado and conceded that while this young Botham chap could certainly swing the ball, his line and length were surely too erratic to trouble any technically correct batsman. Of Latin and Greek there was no discussion, nor, thankfully, of rugger or soccer. I was commended on my choice of college. Queen's used to have a pretty decent cuppers side in my day. Oliver Popplewell kept wicket first class. I forbore to mention that this same Oliver Popplewell, a friend of the family and now a distinguished QC, had just a few months earlier stood up in his wig and gown and spoken on my behalf at a criminal hearing in Swindon. It didn't seem like the right moment. Valentine Senior stood up and shook my hand.
"I expect they'll want you as soon as possible," he said. "You can catch the fast train to York at Peterborough."
"So you're..."
"Oh, heavens, yes. Just the sort of chap Jeremy will be delighted to have on the staff."
I caught the train and arrived at Cundall, a teacher and just the sort of chap. Was I now so very different a figure from the thieving, deceitful little shit who had been such a torment to his family for the past 10 years? Was all the fury, dishonesty, and desire gone, all passion spent, all greed sated? I certainly didn't believe that I was likely to steal again. I had grown up enough to know how to focus and work and take responsibility for myself. All the adult voices that had shouted in my ear, "Think, Stephen, use your common sense, work, concentrate, consider other people, think, 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 think," seemed finally to have got through. I had an honest, ordered, respectable, and unexciting life to look forward to. I had sown my wild oats, and it was time to grow sage. Or so I imagined. I was still a smoker. In fact, to suit my new role of schoolmaster, I had moved from hand-rolled cigarettes to a pipe. My father had smoked pipes throughout my childhood. Sherlock Holmes, veneration of whom had been the direct cause of my expulsion from Uppingham, was the most celebrated pipe smoker of them all. A pipe was to me a symbol of work, thought, reason, self-control, concentration, it is quite a three-pipe problem, Watson, maturity, insight, intellectual strength, manliness, and moral integrity. My father and Holmes had all those qualities, and I wanted to reassure myself and those around me that I did too. Another reason for choosing a pipe, I suppose, was that at Cundall Manor, the Yorkshire prep school at which I'd been offered a post as an assistant master, I was closer in age to the boys than to the other members of staff, and I felt, therefore, that I required a look that would mark me out as an adult. A briar pipe and a tweed jacket with leather patches at the elbows seemed to answer the case perfectly. The fact that a lanky late adolescent smoking a pipe looks the worst kind of pompous and pretentious twazzock did not cross my mind, and those around me were too kind to point it out. The boys called me the Towering Inferno, but perhaps because the headmaster was also a pipe smoker, the habit itself went unchallenged. I still had no need to shave, and the flop of straight hair that to this day I can do nothing about continued to contradict my desire to project maturity.
Looking more panty-waist than professorial and more milquetoast than macho, I puffed benignly about the school as happy as I had ever been in all my young life. Having said which, the first week had been hell. It had never occurred to me that teaching could be so tiring. My duties, as a valet would say, were extensive. Not just teaching and keeping order in the form room, but preparing lessons, correcting and marking written work, giving extra tuition, covering for other masters, and being on call for everything and everyone from the morning bell before breakfast to lights out at night. Since I lived in the school and had no ties of marriage outside it, the headmaster and other senior staff were able to make as much use of me as they wished. I had ostensibly been hired as the replacement for a sweet, gentle old fellow called Noel Kemp Welsh, who had slipped on the ice and fractured his pelvic girdle at the beginning of term. The kernel of my work, therefore, was to take his Latin, Greek, and French lessons, but I very soon found myself standing in for the headmaster and other members of staff, giving classes in history, maths, geography, and science. On my third day, I was told to go and teach biology to the upper fifth. "What are they covering at the moment?" I asked. My knowledge of the subject was sketchy. "Human reproduction." I learnt a great deal that morning, both about teaching and, as it happens, about human reproduction, too. "So," I had said to the class, "tell me what you know." I made it sound as if I was testing them, and nodded importantly as they replied. In fact, of course, I was temporising wildly. I listened fascinated, repelled, and disbelieving as they outlined the details of pipes and glands and flaps and protuberances of which I had heard, but with whose forms, features, and functions I was entirely unfamiliar. The vas deferens, the fallopian tubes, the epididymis, the clitoris, and the frenulum. It was engrossingly gross. I left the science room most impressed by the depth and range of the upper fifth's knowledge. When there were no lessons, the Cundall Manor timetable was devoted to manly pursuits. Without the slightest familiarity with the rules of either game, I found myself running about rugby and soccer fields with a whistle between my teeth. I discovered that if I blew it, dug my heel randomly into the mud, pointed goalward and announced a scrum down or indirect free kick every 5 or 10 minutes or so, I seemed to be able to get by. "But, sir, what was the offence?" "Don't think I didn't see, Hayden Jones. Surely it should be a direct free kick, sir." "If it was a direct free kick, I would have awarded a direct free kick, wouldn't I?" If it was a great joke that I, a sports-hating, disruptive, antisocial, rebellious, triple-expulsee probationary criminal, should now be dishing out punishments, blowing referees' whistles, and calling for silence at morning prayers, then it was not a joke that I ever much stopped to examine or smile over. So far as I was concerned, my reinvention was complete, and the sly, furtive Stephen who had slunk about on the outside of the healthy, decent world was dead and wholly unconnected to the amiable young fogey who made puns in Latin and threatened to flog the fourth form to within an inch of their miserable lives if they couldn't keep quiet for a second, damn it all to Hades and back, and face the front, Halliday, or I shall whip you with scorpions by the bowels of Christ, I shall. Such threats were comic hyperbole, of course, but corporal punishment did still exist in those days and at that school. Did I ever raise my hand in violence to a child in the name of discipline and good order? Yes, I confess that I did. I had been beaten myself at school and had never questioned the role of the cane, ruler, or slipper in school life. Before you wring your hands or make to wring my neck, let me explain. It came about like this. I am on duty one evening, about a month into my first term. This means that I have to settle the boys down for the night, put out the lights, and remain on call for any emergencies and unexpected crises. The dormitories at Cundall are named after seabirds, avocet, guillemot, oyster catcher, that sort of thing. At my own prep school, they'd been named after trees, beech, elm, oak, and sycamore. I suppose in the 21st century's more sophisticated, child-friendly establishments, school sleeping quarters are now called Ferrari, Aston Martin, Porsche and Lamborghini, or Chardonnay, Merlot, Pinot Noir and Shiraz, or even Beyoncé, Britney, Jay-Z and Gaga. But in my era, the era of Peter Scott, Gerald Durrell and the Tufty Club, nature and woodland creatures were considered the most meet and seemly sources for boyhood inspiration. I switch out the lights in Tern and Puffin and walk along the top landing towards Cormorant, from which dormitory issues an inordinate amount of noise. All right, settle down in here. Why is it always Cormorant? Sir, sir, my pillow's broken. Sir, there's a terrible draught in here. Sir, I'm sure I saw a ghost. We're scared, sir. Look, enough. I'm turning the lights out. Not a squeak. Not a squeak. And yes, Phillips, that does include you. Downstairs I go and into the staff room. A fire is blazing, and I sit down with a pile of exercise books for marking. Before I begin the business of correcting, I fish the pipe from the pocket of my tweed jacket. I bring out with it a smoker's friend, combination penknife, reamer, tamper, and bradawl. I fiddle and scrape and poke for a while, banging out the dottle from my previous pipeful into an ashtray and puffing down the stem like a horn player warming up his trumpet. Next, I prize open a tin of Player's Whiskey Flake and peel back a single layer of firm, slightly moist tobacco. The sweet, woody smell, laced with something that may or may not be the whiskey that the brand name promises, rises up to greet me like a holy balm. I lay the wedge in my left hand, and with the tips of the fingers of my right, I begin to massage it into the palm with a firm circular motion. Most pipe smokers prefer a pouch of ready rubbed, but for me, the ritual of loosening and shredding a pressed wafer of tobacco is almost as important as the inhalation of smoke itself. There is an excellent line in Ian Fleming's last Bond novel, The Man with the Golden Gun. The best drink in the day, he observes, is just before the first one. So it is with my habit. The best smoke for me is the one I have in my head while I am priming the pipe and preparing to puff. Just as I'm about to pack the bowl and fire up, I hear above me the thudding of bare feet on floorboards. Cormorant. With an exasperated sigh, I lay down the pipe and next to it the tangle of freshly rubbed tobacco. As I ascend the stairs, I hear stifled giggles and slaps, snaps and whispers. I stride in and switch on the lights. A ritualized fight is in progress, now frozen in the sudden illumination. School ties are being cracked and flicked like whips. I remember these fights from my own dormitory days. Silence! Back into bed, all of you, right this minute! A scramble as they leap into their beds and instantly pretend to be asleep. I switch out the lights. One more sound from this dormitory and whoever is responsible will be for the whack. Do you understand? For the whack, I mean it. Back in the study, I note with disappointment that the 2 or 3 minutes that the ball of tobacco has spent on my desk has been enough to dry its loosened shreds a little. I fill the bowl and press the tobacco down with my thumb, still moist enough to pack well, firm, with a hint of springiness. Now comes the moment my brain and lungs have been aching for. Only Swan Vestas will do at this point. No other incendiary device is quite up to the mark. Not specialised pipe smokers' lighters, however cunning and elaborate. Not Bryant and May matches. Not a Bic, Clipper, Zippo, Ronson, Calibri, Dupont or Dunhill. Excellent in their own ways, as they all may be. Swan Vestas are real matches. Which is to say, you can scrape their magenta heads against any rough surface, not just the shiny brown strips to which the safety match is restricted. You can use a brick in the wall, or, like a cowboy, the heel of your boot.